You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
This is Bird Note. With birds coming in all the bright colors of the rainbow, why are blackbirds black? One possible answer is that black is conspicuous against just about all of nature's backgrounds. So if a bird wants to be seen, black isn't a bad color to be. But why would a blackbird want to be seen? Perhaps it's because many blackbirds are flocking birds. These brewer's blackbirds wander around the countryside in flocks after the breeding season. They feed on the ground, and whenever a predator approaches, members of the flock sound the alarm and take flight. Being black allows them to see each other clearly. This quick recognition, in turn, enables them to come together quickly in a dense mass, which may confuse the predator and thwart its attempts to catch one of the birds. Forming large groups seems to be an integral part of the life of most species of blackbirds, from cowbirds to grackles to these red-winged blackbirds we're hearing. And Mother Nature's painting them black helps them gather together in self-protective flocks. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Michael Robert Kaditz. I have two co-hosts with me today. I have Hale Rothery, one of our regulars, a fellow alumnus from Vancouver Island University, and a special guest today, Theodore Abbott. Theodore Abbott is a critical urbanist here in Vancouver, where we're recording today. Theodore is a podcaster and an affordable housing advocate. And most interestingly, Theodore was a recent candidate in the Vancouver by-elections for city council. Theodore finished in the top half of a long list of candidates, and he hopefully will run again, but I'm not making any promises for you, Theodore.
Yeah, but we'll see.
You did very well. Only two out of 10 were selected for council seats in the by-election. Theodore is very eloquent. I attended many of the all candidates meetings, and I really have to say, Theodore, you are probably the sharpest, and I'm surprised that you didn't come in number one, but maybe next time. So I thought today we would talk a little bit about an aspect of political philosophy, which is something I've been thinking about, considering many of the events in the world and what's happening in the United States. And it's a question of democracy. What is democracy? And my assertion, to start out, one of my premises, is that democracy is misunderstood and oversimplified by many, many people. And what I mean by that is that often people believe that democracy is merely the fact that there's elections. So if a country has elections, that makes it a democratic country. And my claim is that couldn't be further from the truth. Many obviously non-democratic, authoritarian, totalitarian, even fascist countries have elections, have had elections. Russia, for example, has elections. So elections doesn't make a country democratic. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The elections might not be free and fair. And even if they are free and fair elections, then there are many other characteristics of a society which suggest whether we can call that reasonably democratic or not. It has to do with the behavior of politicians, with the way the country is structured. And so I wanted to go over today a few of what I believe are important aspects of a society or of a political system which tend to justify calling that that system or that society, that country, that province, that municipality as democratic, besides whether there's elections or not. So let's just say it's a given that there's going to be elections, but that does not make the society democratic. I wanted to go through a few of the characteristics of what I would say a democratic society would have, and then let's see what Theodore and what Hale have to say about those, and if we can come up with some examples of whether we have those characteristics. We're going to kind of take this down to a local and provincial level today rather than a nationwide level. We often don't talk about the workings of a city or of a province with respect to is it fair, is it democratic, what's going on in that more local entity. So let's start with the idea of voter suppression. So I know that here in Vancouver, where we're recording today, we just had a by-election, and there were some problems with that election having to do with availability of polling places and long lines. Theodore, can you shed some light on what the problem was, and is there anything that you or your party, kind of after the election, are doing to kind of review what happened and maybe change things in the future?
Yeah, well, Phil, first of all, thank you for that great introduction, and I think you covered a lot of ground there in the preamble. We had an election in Vancouver, and we had a by-election. It was our first by-election since, I believe, 2017. And in 2017, there were 50% more polling stations than there were in the 2025 by-election. So we cut them in half. A lot of people thought that this was, you know, some people thought that this was intentional, that this was an intentional move to try to suppress voters in certain neighborhoods. Other people, and I'm sort of this camp, just saw it as another mark of incompetence in an otherwise, like, pretty consistently incompetent regime. And I think that that's more likely the case. If voter suppression was like a convenient byproduct of that, then, you know, I'm sure they're not going to, you know, like they're not going to complain about that. But yeah, so, I mean, it was a real shame. And I even on voting night at like 6:30, you know, right before the polls had closed, I was handing out flyers on Broadway, giving out the last of our pamphlets, and people were taking them and they were saying, I wanted to vote for you, but I waited in line for 2 hours and I just can't, like, or they went and they said, I went to the voting station, I went to the community center, and there's no way I'm going to stand in line for that long. Like, I have a busy, this is my weekend, I got stuff to do. And so people really did want to get out and participate. And we did see, this is another important dimension of the whole debacle to consider, is in the last by-election, we had 11% turnout in 2017. In this by-election, we had a jump to 15%, so a marginal increase. Nothing crazy, but enough of an increase that it meant that their reduction in the number of polling stations resulted in a bit of a, you know, a bit of a debacle, you know, huge long lines. And so, I don't know, did they see this coming? I don't think that people calculated correctly how unpopular Ken Sim became in the last 2 years. The by-election largely was a referendum on Sim. There were no other issues that were on the ballot. It was basically, you're voting for him or against him. That is evidenced by the fact that his two groomed candidates, Ralph Kaisers and Jamie Stein, two, like, you know, very establishment figures, they didn't even break 10,000 votes, right? They got destroyed.
And they both came in way behind you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Jamie Stein's a liberal, like a formerly BC Liberal, now BC United guy. He ran with them, and then Ralph Kaisers is the president of the Vancouver Police Union. So he's been within that world. You know, he's been a power maker in the city for years, and they got beat by, you know, a 27-year-old with zero experience. Like, but they, in terms of voter suppression, there were so many factors that went into how V-Day played out and how people were turned away from the polls. I don't know if you can point the finger at any one person. You know, I said that someone should get fired. Obviously, that probably didn't happen. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a failure on the part of the city. The city did not provide the infrastructure and the staffing necessary to allow people to vote. End of story. And people obviously wanted to.
Yeah, and I'll say even from my perspective, just as a more standard or just average voter, Vancouverite, my partner and I did go to our local polling station to vote at one point, and exactly as what you're describing happened, we got there later in the evening, and there was just a ginormous line all around. It was at Douglas Park, so all around Douglas Park. And so unfortunately, we had other stuff going on, and we literally just couldn't – it was just we couldn't stand in line for an hour and a half, right? So, which is unfortunate. We wanted to vote. But it's speaking to exactly what you were saying, that obviously was happening. We saw that ourselves.
I don't know if it was enough. Like, I think that certain people do think that the margin of error was enough to actually turn the vote a different way. I don't know if it was. I don't know if 15,000 people didn't get to cast their ballot, but maybe. And we'll never know. Like we won't ever know. And I know there's been some research done by a few different people who have tried to put this by-election under a microscope and say, like, you know, what happened. But yeah, we can't really know what if.
Yeah, well, which brings to mind, incidentally, maybe I'm off on a bit of a tangent, but there's been several examples. Also, this recent federal election in some of the ridings in various parts of the country, where there was some real question as to who was the real winner, because the vote spread was like one or two or three votes, and they did recounts, and then it switched it the other way by a couple votes, and then there was some, I forgot the exact riding it was, but there was some votes that were discovered that had been returned because the pre-printed return envelope had the wrong address on it or the wrong postal code or something. What makes Canada different than the United States, for example, is in the United States, when Trump lost an election, he forever and continues to claim that the election was unfair. But here in Canada, even when there is some doubt about the results of an election, nobody credible, no one prominent is actually saying, well, the election was unfair, or the election should be reversed, or it was stolen. It's just irregularities which happen inevitably as a result of when it gets so close, only a few votes, you know, there may be irregularities, and people just accept it. So maybe the counts were wrong someplace, but people accept it because you just have to draw the line and say the election's over. That's what we do here in Canada. But in the United States, it's like it forever becomes an issue, right, of a stolen election.
Yeah, and I'll say this. One of my big takeaways coming out of the by-election was that, just to contextualize this for anyone who's not familiar, in Vancouver, we don't have a ward system. We don't have ridings. And we're the only major city in Canada that doesn't have that. Even other levels of government, provincial and federal, you have an MP or an MLA that's elected in your neighborhood, your specific area. Every single Vancouver city councillor is elected at large. And there's a huge, huge problem. This is evidenced by the fact that, I mean, the whole by-election would have been an afterthought had we had a ward system. It's just two neighborhoods, you know, Riley Park or Commercial Drive, you know, Grandview Woodland would have got together and decided who's the best candidate, and then they would have voted for their person. Instead, the whole city has to get together for this massive by-election. Historically, the lack of a ward system in Vancouver has privileged the West Side. It's privileged neighborhoods with a higher concentration of home ownership. Not only that, we haven't increased the number of city councillors in Vancouver since 1957. So you talk about democracy, like we are perhaps the most underrepresented and undemocratic city in Canada. You look at Halifax, you look at Mississauga, you look at Edmonton, Ottawa. These are all cities with populations that are comparable to Vancouver's, and they all have ward systems. And they all, not only do they have ward systems, they all have more councillors. Halifax is the best example. They got about 600,000 residents. They have 16 councillors elected in 16 different wards, or they call them boroughs. Like, same with Montreal, Toronto, they call them boroughs or what have you. And so Vancouver is this wild west anomaly in terms of the conversation about democracy. We are underrepresented. The number of councillors needs to increase, and we need to get a frickin' ward system like yesterday.
So can you explain how does not having a ward system, so you basically just have generalized councillors that cover the whole of the city, how does that benefit specific or like more, and you were saying, when you say the West End, for those of you who don't know listening, that's generally more of an affluent area of Vancouver. How does that kind of system benefit those sorts of neighborhoods or citizens?
It's if you look at the concentration historically of where the councillors who've gotten elected have been from, it's been in those neighborhoods, and then obviously they advocate for those neighborhoods. So like there hasn't been you know, the Downtown East Side, for example, like we had Gene Swanson, who's a Downtown East Side advocate and resident, elected, I think, once or twice. More often than not, you'd have councillors being elected from areas like Kits or Caresdale, and they're going to do the bidding of that neighborhood. And I just think it's a product of the fact that it costs money to run. And it also means, like, even to have, like, your life together enough in order to get, you know, get into an election and get nominated is just something that I think I think it's a class issue, and upper middle class people are more likely to have that autonomy.
Well, I think that the autonomy to run as a candidate, but also to the ability to vote, I would presume is probably easier or at times more accessible if you are financially affluent. That gives you a kind of freedom and flexibility that a lot of times, if you're living in a high degree of poverty or whatever it might be, there's going to be a decreased access of information, a decreased ability to or flexibility a lot of times in your schedule, that kind of thing, right? So it does, as you said, it does make sense to me as to why that would be the case. It's interesting.
People that have their basic needs met, food, shelter, and so on, have the luxury of pursuing goals higher up on the pyramid, and those who are struggling just to pay their rent, just to eat, who maybe are unemployed or have very low paying jobs, they just don't have the time, resources and luxury to pursue political careers. So yeah. That's got to be part of it.
And this is, you know, I'm really trying to get the ward conversation back happening in Vancouver. It's been about 10 years since anyone's really talked about it. And if I have any involvement in civics in the next year leading up to 2026, it'll be just to try to get that conversation happening. So we have I'm facilitating a little workshop on this in September. And I'll just quote, you know, David Harvey, who's a geographer, you know, critical urbanist. He wrote this book in 2010 called Rebel Cities. And in the book, he outlines the way that in cities that have a weak democracy, inequality always flourishes. And it's no surprise then that Vancouver is home to the most affluent postal code in Canada and also the poorest postal code in Canada. We have those two extremes. And that is a perfect example of weak democracy, extreme wealth inequality within the city, and a shrinking, I think, largely a shrinking middle class or a shrinking working class in Vancouver.
And it's all ironic because Vancouver has this reputation as being this very like progressive, liberal, west coast city. And that's
totally
one of the reasons I even came to Vancouver is like, oh, wow, I'm going to go to a really progressive city. And then being here now, I'm just like finding out, you know, like under the surface, there's all this stuff going on, like what we're talking about now, which really raises some questions.
It's all form. Is no substance. It's largely a really, really shallow veneer. That whole aesthetic of progressivism, it doesn't have a lot of depth in Vancouver. And so if you want to give it depth, I say, you know, ward systems. There's a few things you could put in place.
Yeah.
But
well, when you describe the fact that we don't have a ward system here in Vancouver and we just have a limited number of councillors. What is it, 11?
10.
10.
10 councillors plus mayor.
Yeah, yeah. Elected at large. It sounds a bit analogous to the problem we have on the national level. I don't know if you agree with this, Theodore or Hale, but I see a problem with winner-take-all system that we have. So in each federal electoral district or federal riding, the winner takes all. And so the minorities, I think, are very underrepresented, certainly at the federal level. You know, they get zero, you know, seats. And isn't it the same thing here in Vancouver? The minorities are underrepresented.
Well, the federal NDP in this past election got this more of the popular vote than the Bloc Québécois, and they have way less seats. And they lost official party status. And so, yeah, case in point, right? Yeah, like, and Trudeau promised us in 2015, he promised us this whole conversation about strengthening democracy. Trudeau said, we're going to give you rep by pop, representation by population. And then he got elected. He got a majority government. And he said, I'm not fucking doing that. Why yeah. would I do that? Yeah. Yeah. And so we still have first past the post. But, yeah, I mean, it's bad.
Yeah, so now we've already covered a number of reasons why we can question the depth, the resilience and so on of what we call democracy, even though we have elections, right? We've already uncovered some of the problems with it. And here's another one that I wanted to talk about, which is the numbers of people that simply don't vote. So you had some insights into that, Theodore. Did you say that? I think you said that many young people simply don't vote, and they do it intentionally. Like, what's that about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm talking about a certain milieu of people who don't vote because they're not informed or because they don't have time, but they conscientiously object to voting because they are opposed to electoral politics. This is not necessarily new. I think just among young people, there is an increasing lack of trust in democracy that has really permeated deeply. And it's been growing. I'd say it's been growing since the assassination of JFK. And now in 2025, here we are. And trust in democracy is at a record low. They just don't feel they're being represented.
Well, that's almost a paradox because people then, according to you, say, well, we don't believe in democracy, or we don't believe that we have a democracy. Or is that what you're saying? They don't think this is a democracy, or that they don't actually believe in democracy?
Well, I think there's two kind of like camps that you see people come from, especially in relationship to the modern culture, especially over the last 10 plus years or so. But the Trump era really has pushed this to an extreme, this kind of cultural nihilism, political nihilism. On the one hand, as you kind of mentioned earlier, Theodore, you have the kind of anarcho-type people where there's a kind of an overt political motivation going on where it's like, I don't want to participate in democracy because I believe this is like a sham. And I'm making the political decision to not participate in this. You know, we're going to tear down this system, whatever it's going to be, right? Like, there's like that kind of view. The view that I do know people like that, but the view that I also see with a lot of younger people is more apathetic. And it's not necessarily that they're ignorant. It's more that they no longer have faith in the system, which is a little bit different than wanting to tear it down. It's simply like I do the kind of more doomer mode. I don't care. It doesn't really represent me. What is this going to do? And like, I'm just going to live my life because everything is kind of screwed up right now.
Right.
And it doesn't matter.
Yeah. But I can see already the fallacy, the logical fallacy in that way of thinking, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you were to say, well, I don't think the system really represents me, so I'm not going to vote. Well, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then it's not going to represent you. So these people that say, well, the democracy here is a sham. Well, yeah, if they don't vote, then their voice isn't heard. And that actually erodes democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there is definitely I love that you brought up like you use the term doomer, because like the whole doomer ethos is an incredibly interesting thing to like dive into, and maybe we won't today, but there is definitely an air of accelerationism in that whole world where there's this belief, whether it's tacit, that they think, you know, the faster this thing comes to a screeching halt, the better. I definitely grew up kind of even believing this a bit, that things are kind of – that the ship is going down and we should probably just do whatever we can to like assist that in happening. And so voting is just – to vote would be to participate in assisting that system, you know, like, for lack of a better, you know.
But I do think that Mikey is correct. There is a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Whether it comes from more of like a politically motivated, like I'm going to actively be involved. Liz, you kind of, I like how you use the term accelerationist, which for if listeners don't know, there's a lot, especially now, there's a lot of kind of political movements on the right and left, which basically have as one of their core tenets that they're going to accelerate the collapse of the modern political social system so that, you know, that can be the grounds for something new. It's generally a terrible idea in my opinion, but there is a lot of perspectives that kind of have that in the background. Either whether you be those sort of more politically motivated people, or it's more of this personal kind of like almost depressive attitude and outlook around more of just like the social cultural milieu where it's like, I just don't care. anymore, basically. And I think that really, especially that side of things, has really accelerated in the last decade with the kind of Trump era, where things become incredibly like nihilistic and almost like politics and social issues have become a show, right? It's just another thing on social media. It's just another thing on the news. It's all kind of BS. And it's like hurting me. Like I know a lot of people who kind of believe that it is like bad for their health, mental well-being to participate in political, social, cultural issues because they've just become all so kind of like toxic or dishonest or sensationalized, yeah, or whatever it might be. But like you're saying, it doesn't matter which end you're on. If both of those motivate you to not participate in the democratic system, then you are basically leaving those gaps open for someone else to fill, and someone else will fill them.
Right. So by not participating, you're not actually furthering the dissolution or the collapse of the system. That's not what's happening. What's happening is you're helping give power to certain people who are likely not the people that are going to act in your interest because you kept your mouth shut. So you've given power away, and that's really what happened, I think, in the last municipal election, not the by-election, but the last municipal election in Vancouver is the ABC party won, but a relatively small percentage of people voted. There's a lot of people that just didn't bother voting, so what do? They hand over power to a party that, we can talk about this now, Theodore, who has not acted in the interest, many believe, you probably would, I guess you would say, of the common citizen of Vancouver, but rather has acted in the interest of, what, developers?
ABC?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, so ABC stands for A Better City Vancouver. And this is a party that I see has largely been usurped by the interests of a small group of developers that City Hall now is basically doing the bidding of. And this is demonstrated and evidenced by the fact that Ken Sim got a lot of money from Chip Wilson. And as some people will know, Chip Wilson from the Lululemon world, but Chip Wilson actually is now one of the like biggest landowners in Vancouver. He's diversified and gone into he has a company called Low Tide Developments. So watch out for Low Tide. And yeah, Chip Wilson, people like Peter Armstrong, who've gone into the development game. These are billionaires who have a great interest in the city of Vancouver approving certain projects and developments and rezonings that will increase the value of their properties that they hold and allow them to build more. There's not a doubt in my mind that ABC doesn't have much interest in acting on the will of the people. And I also think that there's a true zealous belief within that party that they've drunk the Kool-Aid, as it were, when it comes to the development side. And this is opening a whole can of worms. But the development side and the supply side approach to housing, which states that increasing the supply of housing, regardless of what type, will inevitably bring down the prices. And this is a fallacy. It simply isn't the case. And so there's two things. There's definitely developer interest. There's corporate profit interest there. And then there's also kind of a misguided, ignorant belief in voodoo pseudo-economics that's like 1980s trickle-down vestiges of the Reaganomics era.
Which, you know, bringing back to the sort of topic of democracy, there's like the question always basically comes up. It's like, well, obviously, you know, people like Chip Wilson or whatever is a citizen of Vancouver. He's an individual. He has one vote, but obviously he plays and people like him play an outsized influence in comparison to the literal one vote that they get to cast, right? Like, you know, he might technically get to put in one ballot, but his effects on how the government operates are going to be far, far, far greater than basically everyone else who voted, realistically speaking, given the ruling party and stuff.
Yeah, and this is the point to connect this to what we're talking about with like youth disengagement, voter disengagement, lack of trust. I would generally give people a bit of leeway if they tell me they don't vote federally or provincially, because I'm like, totally, I get it. It's very corrupt, deeply corrupt. You don't see the results. But when push comes to shove, you got to vote in the civic election. Because even though people like Chip Wilson and Peter Armstrong wield a tremendous, this billionaire class, even though the billionaire class wields a tremendous bit of power in the city of Vancouver, if we had a voter turnout that was higher than 36%, which is what it was in the last general election, the people could take back this city. And we could have a real, you know, revolutionary, a real turnaround here. But we can't do it without a higher voter turnout. And that's, again, where I'm going to harp on this. That's where the ward system comes back in, because I truly believe that that is one of the missing pieces.
Well, that's also another example of the circular reasoning, the fallacy that I was describing, which is that